The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
I'm Jenna Wortham.
I'm Wesley Morris. We're two culture writers at the New York Times.
I mostly write about how humans relate to technology.
And I mostly write about how popular culture and movies relate to humans.
This is Still Processing. I want to know what's new in your life. What's going on? What are you into?
This is not very profound, but it is bothering the hell out of me.
Okay.
People are eating Tide Pods on purpose.
What? Sounds
adult
disgusting.
Human beings are eating detergent for a game.
No.
There are people who don't have actual food to eat. People are eating Tide Pods instead. Not
just
because
so
they have no food. These aren't homeless people having Tide Pod challenges. This is like, you know, ye old college sophomore.
Ugh, I'll have to Google it later. Sounds terrifying, though.
It's bad. Last week, Dolores O'Riordan died. She was the lead singer of the Cranberries.
Mm-hmm.
I had mixed feelings about the Cranberries when the Cranberries were a thing. But you know how it is. Someone dies. There's a transition from one state to another or something like that. And you have this moment to reassess their work in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
I actually found that band as a grown man much more charming than I found them. And like, and powerful as a rock band.
Mm-hmm.
Than I did as an adolescent, which is strange. But they were in this like interesting moment rock and roll wise. In the early and mid-90s. So we'll play a little bit of Zombie, which I think is my favorite Cranberry song. Listening to her now, I'm so moved by what a good songwriter she was. And she can have this song that's basically about war and violence and simultaneously get at the violence of Irish strife and suffering, but also sing it in this way that makes you think it's about something else.
Yeah.
It's
catchy.
Really, really
such an earworm.
Smart in the way that they do this. And all the songs are about suffering in some ways, like emotional suffering. But there's a sweetness to them that makes them pleasurable, and they give them that, and that gives it its earworm quality.
So what else is grabbing your attention this week?
Well, the Oscar nominations happened on Tuesday.
Ooh, right.
And Tiffany Haddish had a hell of a time getting those names out. Oh, my goodness.
Let her live.
She's living. Anyway, Tiffany Haddish should have been nominated for Best Supporting Actress. She was not. But Jordan Peele and Greta Gerwig were both nominated for Original Screenplay and Director for Get Out.
Amazing.
And Lady Bird. The happiest thing for me was two things. Mary J. Blige is now a double nominee.
Cool.
Crazy.
Very cool.
For acting, we should make that point.
Mm-hmm.
That one of the nominations is for Best Supporting Actress. And my favorite movie, one of my favorite movies from last year, Phantom Thread, which I didn't think was going to get any nominations.
Mm-hmm.
The greatest movie I think I've ever seen about a marriage.
Oh.
Or about marriage, period. Paul Thomas Anderson,
mm-hmm.
the Academy shows up for him.
Okay.
At last.
I'll go see it. I got
William
Pass.
Or, you know, for the first time in a while. But we can talk about that closer to the Academy Awards. But in the meantime, I'm relieved that I don't have to get mad about Jordan Peele and Greta Gerwig being omitted from like Best Director.
We've got enough to be mad about.
That's
so
great.
We can take that off our plates.
Yes. What's going on with you?
Okay. Big personal news. You ready?
Mm-mm.
I updated my Instagram app and there's a filter that's not that new, but I didn't have access to it before. But it basically is called a super zoom, and then it overlays this really syrupy sweet, you know, like TV series credit sound that's like And I love it. I've been playing with it so much, and I can't figure out what it is, but I think I'm getting really excited about using social media for other things beyond just venting and beyond just complaining. Like, I just want to have fun with technology again. It's been stressing me out. It's my daily source of stress and high blood pressure. But this, for some reason, just brought me so much joy. I made 25 videos. I've been showing them to everybody. I've just been doing it nonstop. And I don't know, just it's nice to feel joy from a piece of technology for once. It's tracking my face. It's doing all these things. Okay, fine. But I'm still enjoying it.
What else is going on, Punky Brewster?
I, too, am excited for the Grammys. It's been a very long time since there have been women beyond Beyonce and Rihanna to root for at the Grammys. And this year we've got Cardi B in two categories, SZA in five. I've been a huge champion of both all season two, all summer long, as you know. I had to get you over to the dark side, okay? SZA and Cardi. Anyway, I'm just very excited to celebrate them both, and I hope they take home all the awards because they deserve them. And I just feel they're not traditional artists that are typically represented at the Grammys, and I just feel like it feels important to me, and it feels important to recognize, despite all the other things we're going to get into. I'm just excited for them. You know?
Yeah. Now I'm excited. I'm excited for most of the entire evening.
You know what else I've been getting into lately? Amazon's new anthology called Electric Dreams, which is based on short stories by the sci-fi author Philip K. Dick. They're pretty dystopian. They're very star-studded. Janelle Monáe's in one. Steve Buscemi's in another. Terrence Howard's in one. Dee Reese directs another. They're very like bougie and flashy in that way. And I wouldn't say that any of them are that good necessarily, but I am encouraged and excited by shows that are exploring our relationship to the way culture has changed, the world has changed, the way society has changed, and there are these new moral obligations and ethical dilemmas that are arising just because of new scenarios that we're in. So it's not great. I can't really recommend it, but I am very intrigued by this new landscape that's emerging. That's not just Black Mirror-y, like, everything's gonna kill you! Like, all technology is bad! It's just trying to understand what it means that we can use virtual reality to experience life through another person's perspective. Like, what does that mean? And what does that look like? What does
that feel like?
It feels like we're just developing a new language for trying to think through some of the new dynamics we're in because of the world we live in right now, the world we're going to live in. I'm enjoying it. I don't know.
What else?
Oh, that's all I've got.
Well, then I guess we got to do a show now.
Okay, Wesley. So this week we have a very ambitious show. There are a lot of things we're trying to fit into the same context. We're coming into this looking at the Grammys, which are happening this weekend, and trying to unpack the nominations and look at a major omission being that of Ed Sheeran, who's not in any of the top categories. And by all accounts, really had the song of the year. So we're trying to understand what it means that he's not included as having contributed something musically of value in 2017. And within that conversation about Ed Sheeran, we're also going to have a conversation about a preemptive strike against an outrage about what might happen, what would happen at the Grammys if someone like Ed Sheeran were to take home every award over other nominees like Jay-Z or Kendrick Lamar. So that's one type of conversation we're going to be having. The other side of it is looking at where else we're experiencing a large outpouring of outrage in our country, which is around sexual assault and the latest wrinkle in this ongoing, I guess, narrative and story, which is the account of a date with Aziz Ansari and a woman named Grace that is being hotly debated across every major platform and across all the feeds where people can't figure out if this was what she said it was, if he was in the wrong, if she was in the right, but also really trying to understand what it means in our culture, what stories we pay attention to, whose outrage is valuable, what outrage counts, what anger counts.
Yeah, and like what retributive justice is, what it means to dole out punishments against these men. You know, for the last couple of years, we've been trivializing this idea of outrage, or it's been treated as being trivialized. You know, we're outraged about all this stuff, and none of it is really consequential. But now we're at a moment where the outrage is being aimed at things and can potentially do something, and what it means for these things to be converging on each other, or what it means for us to try to make them converge. And this might not seem like a natural thing to do. But I don't know. I feel like there's something there between these two ideas, between these two problems, basically. We're just going to try to connect and see what we think is going on between the Ed Sheeran problem and the Aziz Ansari problem. Mm-hmm. I think that they have something in common.
Me too.
And I think that it would be really, really useful, at least for me, to try to talk to you about what those commonalities are.
And we should say, too, you know, that we're going to have a serious conversation and some of the issues are really sensitive. And we are talking about sexual violence. We are talking about sexual abuse. So just to proceed with caution, because it could be upsetting for some of our listeners.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made. Or how a wooden table is built, piece by piece. And in not-so-small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
The club isn't the best place to find a lover, so the bar is where I go.
First of all, who is Ed Sheeran? Like, you need to bring me up to speed on everything, pretty much. I know who he is. I know what he looks like. I know he has red hair. I know he has a popular song. But why is Ed Sheeran such a big deal? And also, what happened with him at the Grammys? I think you just have to summarize it, because I didn't even know until you told me.
Well, who Ed Sheeran is a much bigger existential and ontological question than I'm prepared to answer for you right now. But basically, what happened at the Grammys is, like, an artist who basically was made for the Recording Academy, you know, in the form of a wholesome-seeming white kid who has a lot of musical talent and plays popular music that people like.
He's a bot.
Ed Sheeran now is what I would say is he's in that Taylor Swift, Adele class of person. Now my bedsheets smell like you, every day discovering something brand new. I'm in love with your body. Doesn't matter whether you like The Shape of You, doesn't matter whether or not that song got on your nerves, whether you thought it was stupid, whether you thought he should have just left the Caribbean sound in the Caribbean where he's probably never been. Those things don't matter.
Yeah.
What matters is Ed Sheeran had the song of the year.
It was like the most streamed, most purchased, most, you know, rewound, most remixed, most sampled, most Shazammed, whatever. But he had the most popular song of the year.
Yes. I mean, the Billboard chart, he's now had the longest charting single in Billboard history. And John Pareles, our colleague in the culture department at the New York Times, did a Why the Shape of You was the record of the year, like, forensically.
Right.
And so he goes and talks to Ed Sheeran. And it was just really exciting listening to them sort of talk about this very simple idea that he wanted to use the same hook from the chorus of No Scrubs. They still share a songwriting credit with the people who wrote No Scrubs.
Definitely. And I'm singing like, girl, you know I want your love. Your love was handmade for
somebody like me. Come on now, follow my lead. I may be crazy, don't mind me. Say, boy, let's not talk too much. Grab on my waist and put that body on me. Come on now, follow my lead. Come, come on now, follow my lead. Mm-hmm.
This song is, it's a perfect, perfect, perfect pop song. By the time it's over and all the different musical elements have come together to send you out,
mm-hmm.
that's a dealer basically saying, look, man, if you want more, you gotta come back.
Now my bedsheets smell like you. Every day discovering something brand new. I'm in love with your body.
This year would have been the year when he would have been consecrated as an Adele or a Taylor Swift. Mm-hmm. But a funny thing happened on the way to Record of the Year, Album of the Year, mm-hmm. and Song of the Year. No Ed Sheeran!
I'm in love with the shape of you.
Every so often there's a song like that that hits, that's everywhere and it's infectious and it's just, it gets so stuck in your head and the people singing it look nothing like the way the song makes you feel, which allows, no, it's true. There have been a couple of songs like this that just keep emerging and it's like, you know, it just, it allows this association where you don't really have to have strong feelings about it other than that, like, it's catchy. You know what? Like, I don't know how I feel about Ed. I don't know how I feel about this genre of music, but as a standalone pleasure unit, you know, it's great.
Yes.
Like, it just does all the things for
it
you.
It does all the things for you.
I mean, I tried really hard to resist it. I tried over and over again, but I think maybe the third or fourth time I was in a bodega shopping for something and it came on,
it's always
and I just
bodega.
Felt my little hips start to twitch. I was just like, whatever, I'm good with it. Okay, but the reason this is significant, it's not just because it's a very good song. It's not just because it sold however many copies it has to sell for this kind of consideration or streamed however many hundreds of millions of times it had to stream to get this kind of consideration. It's important because
2 billion YouTube plays.
That's a lot. It's hard for me to even understand how much that is, but that's a lot. There are two really important milestones that revolve around Ed Sheeran's omission from the top categories of the Grammys. The first one is probably the most important, which is that this is the first time in the Recording Academy's history that a white man has not been nominated for Album of the Year.
Yep. So let's just go through the nominees really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Childish Gambino for Awaken My Love, 444, mm-hmm. Jay-Z, Damn, Kendrick Lamar, mm-hmm. Lords, Melodrama, and 24 Karat Magic by Bruno Mars.
Right. And I think a lot of people would hear that list and be like, good. Like, so what if Ed Sheeran doesn't, you know, he doesn't make it in? So what if he loses out this one time? But it's actually a lot more complicated than that. And I think the other thing we have to be really mindful of is what happened the last Grammys, and actually the 2015 Grammys with Beck and Beyonce. But basically, it all, as always, comes back to the Illuminati and Beyonce. No, I'm just kidding. But I will say, though, that I think we can look at what happened last year with, you know, we talked about this on the show, which was that Adele won for Record of the Year over Beyonce. And in Adele's acceptance speech, she basically apologized to Beyonce for winning.
Tonight winning this kind of feels full circle, and like a bit of me has come back to myself, but I can't possibly accept this award. And I'm very humbled and I'm very grateful and gracious, but my artist of my life is Beyoncé, and this album for me, the Lemonade album, was just so monumental, Beyoncé. It was so monumental and so well thought out. And so beautiful and soul-bearing, and we all got to see another side to you that you don't always let us see, and we appreciate that.
And the way she handled it and the things she said were very moving and very lovely, and I think everything was in the right spirit. But the point is, there was this pressure because, you know, it felt like she was taking something from Beyonce, and that was going to be the perception. So that's the cultural antecedent to this. That's what's leading us basically to this point is
right.
That maybe we can assume, and we should get into this, whether or not how valid this theory is and how much we can assume that the Recording Academy doesn't want to have another hashtag Grammy So White or whatever it was last year after Adele swept.
This is something that someone gave me this idea. And then once it was presented to me as a possibility, my brain just exploded and
yeah.
I just ran with it.
Yeah.
But basically, unlike, say, the Academy Awards, where the nominations basically happen without a steering committee, basically,
mm-hmm.
the Grammys have what they call a nominations review committee, which basically can look at the prospective nominees.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's for all 86 categories, but obviously definitely the top ones.
Interesting.
And so they can look at the list. And they can see that Divide by Ed Sheeran, the album, is one of the five Grammy nominees. And a lot of people on that committee might look at that list and be like, well, let's see, we got Jay-Z, we got Kendrick, we got Childish Gambino, we got Ed Sheeran and Lorde. There's a strong possibility that if this is opened out to the wider 16,000 people in the Recording Academy, Ed Sheeran could probably win, and we might have a little bit of a mess on our hands if he upsets Kendrick or Jay-Z. We don't want to deal with that. This is all that ever happens. People are still mad at us over Beck, over Beyonce. People are still mad at us about Taylor Swift over Beyonce.
Bon Iver, remember when everyone was like, who's Bon Iver? Remember that was like, if you type in who is, people didn't even know it was Bon Iver. It was like, who the heck is Bon Iver? Anyway, it's interesting because it's like raises this question about how valid are the Grammys as a metric or a measure of a cultural tempo? I mean, what do you think? Like, do you think this is sort of an actual watershed award for what is an album of a year?
I think a lot of people would hear a conversation like this and be like, why are you guys wasting 10 seconds talking about the Grammy Awards? They don't matter. It's a bunch of old white people and some brown people mixed in there a little bit making decisions about who and what is good.
Mm-hmm.
And they've never meant anything. They have no validity whatsoever. And why are you wasting your time? I will just say, as an institutionalist, per someone who believes in, if not the institution themselves, then in the fact that their mere existence means that they send signals and send messages and are responsible for certain kinds of cultural consecrations, it does matter what the Grammys say and do and present to you as the best.
Right.
Not because it actually is the best, but it's what the people who make this music think is good.
Right. And I think the thing that's challenging is, you know, someone like Ed Sheeran, who is just, he really is kind of a perfectly crafted, like, fembot of music or something where he's just, it's like all the parts match up for, like, maximum popularity. It's like,
he's the Grammiest.
That's good. You know, it can feel like we're all living, we being a very royal we're all living in the same cultural moment. And I think that there are instances where things like the Grammys happen or the Oscars happen where you realize that, like, oh yeah, everyone's, there are different priorities at stake here. Not everyone is sort of believing we're living in a moment where an album like Damn is really important and interesting.
Right.
Or
right.
An album like 444 is, I mean, and also we haven't even talked about that Lorde's the only woman in that category anyway. Is Lorde the only woman that made an album worth recognizing this year? I mean, I have a hard time believing that. But
that's not true.
It's not true. So, you know, it's already a flawed mechanism is right. What I'm trying to say.
But what we're really, really talking about, though, is not whether or like what should be winning these Grammys. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is what it would mean if it's actually true that the nomination steering committee or whoever whatever we're calling this organization looked at the list and said, oh, my God, if this gets out to the wider voting body, we're going to have a problem on our hands, and I don't want to deal with any more race war stuff. People are mad enough as it is.
Yep.
Just give Ed Sheeran the pop grid.
He'll be fine.
Just
he'll
put
actually
him,
be
put
fine.
Him in, put him in yep. pop song of the year.
He'll be fine.
Put him in pop vocal performance. Put him in pop album. Just get him out of the major categories because he's going to win and people are going to be mad.
And so then what we're really talking about is a conversation around what it means to try to preemptively prevent a reaction, what it means to have someone like Ed Sheeran become collateral damage. I mean, that's what we're really talking about.
Yes.
Is who can afford to be collateral damage? Because Ed will be fine. He just got engaged. Like, he's going to make so many more albums. He's going to sell so many more tours. Like, no one is out here worried about the artistic merit of Ed Sheeran. He's fine. We can just leave him off the table.
Right.
But that's a really flawed argument.
I think so. I mean, I think that I'm the kind of person who wants to know where my racism is.
Always.
I don't want you telling me that by cutting Ed Sheeran out of your little Grammy game that you've solved Grammy racism. So that you're going to do this next year Taylor Swift is eligible for all these Grammys?
Oh my God, yeah.
You're going to do this again when Adele puts out another record the same year as Beyonce? This is the slippery slope. The thing that really bothers me about this whole thing, aside from you presenting a distorted picture of what was great about 2017 or important or what happened courtesy of the Grammys, which in any other year, this song, The Shape of You, would have been one of your Record of the Year winners or nominees.
Right.
I feel like I'm being told to keep my anger in check and I'm being pandered to in a way that I don't like. And I'd rather see Kendrick or Jay-Z or Childish Gambino or Lorde lose to Ed Sheeran, because that's the way it goes.
I don't want people like Ed Sheeran kept out to deal with the Academy's image problem. I want them to deal with their systemic problem. You know
right.
what I mean?
Yes.
Like, I don't want them to be worried about how they look. I want them to be fixing the music industry so that more people can make interesting music.
Right. And that's not what this does.
I think also a big question we're wrestling with in this episode is 2017 and now the beginning of 2018 are really about a reckoning of power imbalances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what does it look like when we try to fix what we perceive to be wrongs? Who gets punished for it? Who manages to get off without a scratch? And what do we do when the corrective means cause more problems
yep.
than they started to begin with?
That's exactly it. So we're going to take a break. We'll come back and apply that very question to the matter of this Aziz Ansari date and wherever the Me Too moment is right now and wherever it's going. We'll be right back.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
What many fail to understand is that it doesn't have to be rape to ruin your life, and it doesn't have to ruin your life to be worth speaking out about. Any kind of sexual harassment or coercion is unacceptable. So what the f*** are women supposed to do to protect ourselves? If we go public with a story, we're petty crybabies hell-bent on destroying men's careers. If we write a secret list to protect each other, we're gossipy shrews telling lies in the shadows. What men literally cannot understand is, this isn't about them. Whoa!
So that, of course, was Samantha Bee doing a monologue from her show Full Frontal, where she's talking about the response to this movement we're having or this moment we're having where we're looking at instances of sexual misconduct, mostly in the workplace. And she's talking about the response to an anonymous list that came out that named a bunch of men in media that were accused of doing untoward things to women. She's also talking about this anonymous piece that was published very recently on a site called babe.net, where a woman who's going by the name of Grace talks about a date that she went on with Aziz Ansari that went sideways.
Right.
And the reaction to it has been really to discredit Grace, really to talk about whether or not she did experience assault and what it's supposed to look like. And it's kind of the first moment we're seeing a very public acknowledgement of some of the complications of sexual misconduct and how hard it is to talk about. But really, it's also the first time in this wave of an extension of hashtag Me Too stories, the first time we're hearing people and especially prominent women disregard some of the stories that are coming out. So there's starting to be something that feels a little bit of backlashy. We started this whole thing trying to redraw boundaries around power structures and dynamics. And now it feels the lines are being redrawn around what women get to have power over.
Mm.
You're angry enough, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? This is going too far. This story doesn't count. And now we're getting away from what we started out to do.
Yeah.
Which is
you're
really
ruining what we're trying to do with your tale of ambiguity and uncertainty.
Right. And I want to be really clear about what we're connecting with the Ed Sheeran and the Grammys snub. I'm using quotation marks if that's what it is. What we're talking about with Ed Sheeran and the line or the bridge we're trying to erect to this moment, which is both of these instances are responses to anger.
Mm-hmm.
The Grammys are trying to stave off an angry response.
Prophylactic staving off of anger, yes.
And then this instance right now, the thing that Samantha Bee is commenting on is a feeling that women are angry enough, or we've had enough of this anger, or what are we supposed to do with all of your anger? And also, what are you angry about? Right. So it's kind of a weird connection that we're making, but one feels like an outgrowth of the other.
Well, because we're talking about power. We're still talking about power.
We're still talking about power.
And the assumption, I think, that what you're getting in these conversations among these women is the same sort of questioning. Like, it immediately takes the onus off all these dudes in a weird way, mm-hmm. to have all these women fighting about where the lines are. And I just feel like it's not a distraction. I mean, it's a real conversation that has to be happening.
Right.
This is a conversation that I think has to happen among women about what the rules of comportment are, not just for themselves, but for Aziz Ansari. But in a weird way, I think that if we're talking about a kind of collateral damage, mm-hmm. I think that Ed Sheeran, in terms of the racism that's existed in American popular culture since we've had a popular culture,
right.
Ed Sheeran is one of the victims of that, I would say. And there are a lot of people who would be like, fine. I mean, who can, like, okay.
Yeah.
Like, you get rid of Ed Sheeran, there'll be 15 more people just like him. And I think at the same time, Aziz Ansari is, I think, the most prominent example of a person who, while having demonstrated, according to this story that ran on this website, behavior that is questionable in its consideration for the woman he was with, is not equal in any way to any of the other stories of abuse,
right.
and harassment and rape that we've been talking about.
Right.
And so it sets up this zero-sum game, to you, for lack of a better concept,
no, absolutely.
Of what counts.
And instead of having a conversation that's, do we believe this woman, is this a bad date or is it worse, isn't the conversation, or shouldn't the conversation be, why can't there be a gray area, or why can't we have more nuance? What does continuing a sexual re-revolution look like? What does continuing, you know, a power restructuring look like versus, is this woman valid? And I think the notion, too, that somehow a story that falls into a gray area of that feels worthy of debate, whether or not it counts, if that's enough to throw off the momentum of a larger systemic thing that needs to be undone in terms of power dynamics, then the problems are a lot bigger than this right. woman coming forward with this story.
Yep.
Like, it just can't be that there isn't room to talk about things that we can't easily categorize.
Right. And I think that one of the problems, I think, with the way I wouldn't even call it a problem. I think one of the things that I have found fascinating about the way this conversation has taken place is that it seems to be generational, right? And the older women seem angry at younger women for not being older is what it sounds to me like is happening. Like, and I think there's an immediate lack of empathy for how the Catherine Deneuve's and Ashley Banfields of the world were once 22 mm-hmm. and 21.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, the cultures were different at those points. Catherine Deneuve is in her 70s. Ashley Banfield is in her late 40s or early 50s. And I think there's a real refusal to understand that these are positions that you have to age into. And these are experiences that require some seasoning for you to understand where your personal lines are. Because
right.
the one thing about this that has been interesting to me is the ways in which we are trying to legislate something that is beyond legislation in some ways. I mean, these are personal. There are clear things you don't do to another person that are violating and that cross lines, right? Like, rape is bad. Assault is bad. But then there are these weird behavioral things that, like, you have to figure out for yourself.
The incredible thing about the account that Grace shared, assuming all the things in it are true or whatever, but the incredible thing about that story is that it does fall into this area that is harder to define. And it is an area that you can, you know, you can listen to stories of sexual abuse and sexual assault and be like, well, I never did those things. It's not as easy to distance yourself from this story. I think a lot of people can put themselves into either equation of that dynamic and of that story. And I think that's the thing that's really, really, really scary. And I think that's the thing that's harder for us to grapple with, which is, does someone out there have a story about me like this? They probably do. And that's actually the conversation we have to be having, which is, how do we do things like check in with each other during a sexual encounter? How do we find ways to talk about consent that aren't just centered on yes and no? And that's a much harder, that's a much harder series of inquiries to do personally for every single person. And I think that's why the story is being dismissed so easily. Well, this woman was a hussy. This woman did this. This woman's that. We're not going to take this seriously. And don't come for Aziz. He's the only good brown guy we've got. It's like those. I just feel like those are not.
We need to get more brown people then, right? I mean,
we need more. Yeah, but we also
we need more Aziz's then, because.
But we need more cultural acceptance for women and men to be sluttier and for things to be able to not still go sideways. You should be able to go to dinner with someone you meet that's kind of powerful and not feel violated. You should be able. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not as easy as just saying, well, this story doesn't count because it sounds like it was a bad date.
Well, you know, the other thing that's funny is people keep bringing up this modern romance book that Aziz Ansari wrote, this, you know, popular book that he wrote about dating in the 21st century with technology and what that experience is like. But people keep talking about that. It's relevant, I guess, but the book is called Modern Romance. It's not called Modern Sex. There's nothing in this book about, I mean, at least to me, that's convincingly useful about sex, because we don't talk about that. His show, Master of None, is not a show about sex. It's a show about romance, whatever his version of that is.
Right.
And I think that there's a real cultural disconnect among all of us when it comes to how one comports oneself with a thing that nobody can talk about. Nobody really wants to get a proper education in how to have sex.
It's
a thing you learn on the job.
You learn on the fly. And also popular culture, I mean, you've said this before, but popular culture doesn't talk about first sexual encounters other than they're a big deal. You know, like the birds and the bees talk is a big deal. Losing your virginity is a big deal. But we don't have the conversations about, well, what's it like the fifth time you have sex? What's it like the 50th time you have sex?
And what's it like to have sex when you don't even really want to, but you're not being assaulted. You're just being nice. You're being patient.
I know what you're trying to say. I understand what you're trying to say is that it's not always as clear. It's not always.
It's really not always clear. It's very rarely clear. That's, I mean, just to underscore my point about what we don't talk about anymore. We really aren't talking about sex, maybe more than ever, unless it's the worst kind of sex that isn't even sex. It's assault or rape. And It all just feels so toxic and so unhealthy, and I don't know what the thing is going to be that gets us to believe in love or gets us to believe that sex is okay. I mean, we're all going to keep f***ing. That's not going to change.
We just have to talk about it more.
And so, but I just think we have never, ever, we're so puritanical to this day. It's been 400 years. We still don't know what to do with this stuff. This also feels like it happens like every 20 or 30 years, these questions about women being angry. And they usually come about around some kind of sexual injustice. And there's a real reinterrogation of
sexual
rage.
Politics. And what it's for, too.
And I don't, I mean, you know, we're in the middle of, there are three really good essays that were written about on this subject. Leslie Jamison wrote one for the New York Times Magazine that really tried to understand, or tried to, she tried to understand for herself what it meant to be a person who felt disconnected from her rage, because society has sort of taken that away from her.
Well, yes, but also she's socialized. She's talking about the way women, some women are socialized to hide anger, that women are socialized to not feel rage or display it or show it or really engage with it. And it's not taken seriously. A lot of it isn't taken seriously. I mean, I think you can see that with the way the Women's March gets talked about, too, which is that it's treated seriously, like semi-seriously. But I don't think that it's seen as an outgrowth of like waking up with real anger and needing it to go somewhere. And so I think that's why the turnout felt to me, at least remotely, as strong as it looked last year. I mean, Obviously, probably wasn't, but I was surprised at the numbers of people that went and the numbers of people that spoke. I mean, I think this is it's a real demonstration of that anger and a desire to have it not be aimless.
Right.
I think angry women are often discredited as the anger being indiscriminate and the anger ricocheting everywhere and the anger getting all over everything and taking down unfair targets, maybe, like Aziz Ansari. Don't know.
I think one of the things that's interesting about this moment and the rage that I am actually feeling from women, even though I don't agree with some of the anger, like the nature of the anger is what I'm saying, not so much that women shouldn't be angry. But I think Ashley Banfield's anger at the journalist who wrote Grace's story it's kind of refreshing nonetheless, because people are mad. But the problem, of course, is that it's a woman being mad at a woman. And a woman being mad back, because the journalist writes back to Ashley Banfield and says horrible things about her.
Yeah.
And I just feel like there's got to be a way to scoop off some of that.
Yeah.
Some of that intra-female anger. Well, productive, because it is getting at really important questions to be asking about where these lines are. One of the things that, to bring this back to the Grammys for a second, one of the things that you would always object it to last year in this framing of the Grammys of 2017 being about Adele versus Beyonce is that it was a false binary.
Right.
But I also was struck by the idea that it wasn't just a racial preference that might have been expressed by the Academy, by the Recording Academy giving Album of the Year and Record of the Year and Song of the Year to Adele and not Beyonce. It was that they were choosing an album that was emotionally sad over an album that is emotionally angry.
Right.
And that anger is a huge part of that journey on Lemonade. And wistfulness and regret, while strong on 25, are the dominant modes of that album.
Right.
And that was just really striking to me, like sad versus angry, not woman versus woman.
Right, right. Well, one emotion's rewarded and the other one's not.
I don't know what you do with all of this.
I'll tell you what to do with it. Let it out. Keep letting it out. I don't think we're at peak anger. I
think
there's a lot more anger to come. And I think it's useful. And I think that understanding that it doesn't all look the same and it doesn't all sound like the same type of anger, we're not all angry about the same things, is really, really, really important, because there are a lot of things to be angry about. And I think over the weekend, I was talking with a friend of mine who is an artist, and a lot of her work is around language and the words we use to talk about the things that we're feeling. And so in order to express this more fully in her work, she's been taking acting classes. And in the acting classes, one of the directives you get is show me anger, show me excitement. And she was like, you know, everyone has an approximation of what they do when they're angry. It's like you scowl, you stomp around. We all know what a cartoon version of anger looks like. The disconnect that they explore in the class is that's not really what most of us do when we're angry. We do other things with it. It manifests in other ways. It comes out of our body in sometimes very passive ways, sometimes very explosive ways. But we're often not like a cartoon character with like a big upside down, you know, you on our faces. And I guess I've been thinking a lot about that conversation in the sense of this anger is coming out and we've never looked at it at this scale, I don't think, as a culture. And I don't think we felt it from so many different angles. And the Grammys are one outgrowth of it. Me Too is an outgrowth of another. And thinking about what it means that Aziz Ansari went on this really f***ed up date with this woman is another. And I think we're getting better at identifying what different types of anger looks like. We're also getting really good at identifying which kinds of angers we don't talk about or look at or think about. And that's another conversation. I think we're really not looking at Black female anger at all. I ultimately think this is really good for our culture and really good for our country to start expanding our vocabulary and our capacity for rage and for understanding where it's coming from and then what we do with it. Because it's right. I mean, it's true. Like, we're probably not going to have great, you know, systemic overhauls overnight, but there are still things we can do.
Right. But you have to keep that anger. You know, it's funny because I was thinking a lot about how much we've been talking about this date, this bad date that Grace and Aziz Ansari allegedly had. And that story appeared in the same week that these women who had all been sexually abused by that doctor at the University of Michigan, the gymnasts. And we're not angry enough about that.
Yeah.
And what was interesting to me is I'm watching the montages of these women confront this man who did this horrible thing. His name is Dr. Larry Nassar. Not that it really matters, but just so we have some point of identification. Was that you could see 75 different kinds of anger.
Yeah.
You could see 75 different ways of having processed this horrible thing that happened to each and every one of those women that was similar in nature, but right. produced an incredibly different response to a woman. And each woman goes up and she looks at this guy right in his... None of the women look away. They look right at him. And some of them keep it together. Some of them lose it. Some of them are visibly re-traumatized, just as you would be, I would imagine.
Right.
Larry, you do realize now that we, this group of women you so heartlessly abused over such a long period of time, are now a force and you are nothing.
He took photos of us during training and whenever else he wanted. Nobody was protecting us from being taken advantage of.
You made me believe that you were my friend. You deceived me, you manipulated me, and you abused me. I truly believe that you're a spawn of Satan.
Perhaps you have figured it out by now, but little girls don't stay little forever. They grow into strong women that return to destroy your world.
And it was so powerful to me. And you and I have been talking about this, about why... I mean, it's obviously in the news, but there's no outcry about it.
It's not surfacing as much in the feeds as you would think it is. It should be, considering how specific and graphic. I mean, really just horrible. I mean, it's not really. Yeah, I just don't feel like it's part of a conversation that
but
we're having.
This is the anger that we should be talking about, because this is, it's aimed at the person and the power structure that hurt them. And I think that anger is going to turn out to be productive, because I think it has to change where those women practice. I think it has to change the people running that university, because they knew for years this was going on.
They had to have.
He didn't lose his job. And then the people at USA Gymnastics, who also allowed this to go on for as long as however long it was going on, mm-hmm. years there too. Mm-hmm. I mean, at some point the heads are going to start rolling there. And I mean, I just feel like we're talking about more than 100 women. It's insane to me.
Well, there's a new type of solidarity to be found in anger. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a way to use it as a tool. And I do think that is something that's being figured out on the fly. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's a weird conversation. We started with Ed Sheeran. Mm-hmm. We ended up talking about sexual assault of a team of gymnasts, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And
teams,
plural. Jeez Louise. But we're also talking about how, as a culture, we dole out punishment, mm-hmm. and how mm-hmm. we decide which mm-hmm. issues to tackle and what's important. And, you know, it feels clear that there are cultural priorities to yep. what we want to talk about mm-hmm. and what we want to deal with and what we decide is worth validating and dismissing.
It's also easier. It's yeah. also easier to talk about a bad date, what has been written off as a bad date.
Yeah, yeah.
Than it is to talk about all of the systemic stuff.
Right.
And all of the infrastructural stuff.
And what it means to be part of a culture that condones abuse of women.
Right. And this is the thing that's extra annoying to me about the Ed Sheeran thing, which is that, as we've discussed, like, omitting him from Record of the Year solves nothing.
Right. Right.
Like, throwing Ed Sheeran under the bus doesn't really solve this problem. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's sort of what's galling to me, is that there's always an assumption based on the people who control everything that if you throw the people a bone, they'll shut up.
Right.
And it's easy to distract people from the larger problem by, like, allegedly solving these little things.
Right.
But the things that sort of allow these other problems to fester continue.
And what we treat outrage as the problem. We treat
right. Yes.
We treat the loudness as the
we
problem.
We call it hysteria.
Let's be more hysterical.
We call it overreaction.
No,
I mean, we have
more,
a lot of terms for anger
more.
that aren't actual anger.
Right.
They're pejorative and they have nothing to do with the actual healthy release of exasperation and sort of fear-based rage that comes out of these scenarios. And the fear is that, you know, you're not going to value my humanity. And in the case of these gymnasts, their anger is entirely justified.
Yeah.
Not just at the doctor, but at the whole system. And I just think, you know, I don't know. We're talking, you mentioned punishment, and I just feel like it's always the wrong people being punished in a lot of ways. Yeah. Or it's not enough of the right people.
Right.
Might be the better way to think about it.
Well, it's a lot easier to punish someone like Ed Sheeran than to take a really hard look at a system that's been in place for years. I'm thinking specifically about the gymnasts or really any of the misconduct that we've been talking about. It's easier to take it out on someone like Ed than it is to actually do something about it in a much more bigger and meaningful way. It's just not enough. And we're still angry.
Yeah, I'm angry nonetheless.
I'm still angry.
Yeah, it solves nothing. I'm probably twice as angry as I would have been if he had won Record of the Year. So there you go. Thanks, Recording Academy, for that.
Well, that's our show. And when we're done, we're going to drive to a field and just scream our heads off. So you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Let's go. Well, that's our show for the week.
Still Processing is a product of the New York Times.
It is produced by Jenna Weiss-Berman, Josh Gwynn, Ann Hepperman, Henry Malofsky, Jessica Jupiter, and Max Linsky from Pineapple Street Media.
Our editor is Sasha Weiss. We get editorial oversight from Lisa Tobin and Samantha Hennig.
Our theme music is by Kindness. It is called World Restart from the album Otherness.
And you can find all our episodes and a bunch of other stuff that we like and do at nytimes.com/stillprocessing. And once again, we always ask for you to leave us your 2 cents on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate it.
Bye.